at 8 o'clock. The news, excuse me, the morning show is next. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We were going to be sharing with you today an interview with Dr. Michael Hansen from the Political Science Faculty at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside. We are postponing that conversation in order to bring you a different conversation, an interview that was recorded this past Wednesday afternoon and very much related to the difficult, turbulent week that we have experienced here in Kenosha. I want to reemphasize the fact that this interview was recorded back on Wednesday afternoon and recorded before certain information became available about the incident that involving Kenosha police and Jacob Blake that, of course, touched off all of the demonstrations that are continuing, of course. So this interview dates from Wednesday afternoon, and we will be sharing the interview previously scheduled for today with Dr. Michael Hansen next week on the morning show. And we welcome you to the morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I don't have to tell anybody listening to this interview, listening to this broadcast, that the last few days have been tremendously painful and traumatic and frightening for the citizens of Kenosha and for communities just lying beyond. And of course, the reverberation from the shooting of Jacob Blake are being felt in cities all across the country. I feel very privileged indeed that we can have a morning show conversation with Jennifer Kobina, who is professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University and the author of a book called Hands Up, Don't Shoot, Why the Protests in Ferguson and Baltimore Matter, and How They Have Changed America, published by New York University Press. And, of course, we are now joining, that is, Kenosha is joining with an ever-lengthening list of cities in which these kind of controversial and tragic incidents have occurred. And we are feeling the pain of it and dealing with the ramifications of it on all kinds of different levels. And I really appreciate Professor Kobina being able to join us on short notice to talk about her book and to offer any perspective that she might have on the situation with which we are grappling here in Kenosha. Again, her book titled Hands Up, Don't Shoot, Why the Protests in Ferguson and Baltimore Matter, and How They Changed America. Professor Kobina, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Ahead of us talking about the specifics of our current situation, I wonder if you could give us just a brief idea of what has drawn you to this overall topic, even ahead of writing this particular book.
You know, much of my research focuses on issues of the criminal justice system and the systemic barriers that people face within the criminal legal system, and race has always been a central component, whether we're looking at policing, courts, or corrections. And so I've always been drawn to the impact that race has on how individuals of color are treated within the system.
You begin your book with an interesting account of an invitation which you received back in 2014. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, you know, after Michael Brown died in 2014, like many others, I was watching on television what had happened, and I was flabbergasted and outraged by the police response. And I will say I had lived in St. Louis for 5 years while pursuing my doctorate degree at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And I had only lived a couple of minutes from Ferguson. And so one of my colleagues, within a month or so after Michael Brown's death, had emailed me and several other social justice scholars to ask if does anyone want to go to Ferguson and conduct interviews with protesters. We knew that history was in the making, and we wanted the opportunity to hear from the voices of those who are on the ground and protesting and trying to have their voice heard. And so ultimately, we ended up going, and so 2 to 3 months after Michael Brown's death, I went to Ferguson and conducted 100 interviews with protesters and residents in the city of Ferguson. And, you know, unfortunately, 8 months after, Freddie Gray had died, and I did something similar where 3 months after his death, I also went to Baltimore and conducted 92 interviews with activists. And I really wanted to understand people's experiences with the police and how these experiences shape their perceptions. I wanted to know what galvanized the Black Lives Matter movement. And also, given the militarization of the police towards protesters, I wanted to see how those actions impacted activists' willingness to engage in subsequent mobilization efforts.
It's a complicated thing to talk about because we're talking about different events that are tightly woven together and yet, at least in some respects, distinct. We are talking about incidents in which a police officer has acted in a way that at the very least is inappropriate, of course. Most would say absolutely indefensible. And then we have protests that are stirred by that act, and then the police response to those protesters. And so there are a lot of things that go on there. That's, in a sense, a chain of events closely linked. How do you see the importance of, in a sense, keeping them distinct?
So in terms of keeping each of these incidents distinct, I mean, definitely, you know, unfortunately, you know, the script is pretty much the same. You know, we are seeing Black individuals who are killed by the police. They're distinct because these are different individual people who are now suffering, who have now either lost their lives and their families are suffering and struggling, and the community is also reeling. And, you know, oftentimes when these tragic incidents occur, you know, as I mentioned, there's pretty much a script that occurs. That is, it often will elicit outrage and protest in the city and possibly around the nation, and an investigation will be initiated. And the accused officer will be placed on leave. Sometimes that can be paid leave. The officer may or may not be indicted, but the officer is rarely convicted and sentenced to a term of imprisonment. In general, what we see is if the family sues the police department, they will often receive a civil settlement, but there will be no admission of fault by the city or police department. And so that's typically what we see. And there, what we also see such outrage because of this legacy of racial injustice that's taking place because of the number of black and brown individuals who are dying at the hands of the police. And even though many of these tragic encounters are recorded, oftentimes we see officers not being held accountable.
Let me turn for a moment to the current event here in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which, of course, was touched off by the shooting of Jacob Blake. And it was an incident that was caught on video not once, but at least twice, and a truly horrific scene, although there are certain questions that still remain about just exactly what was transpiring. And at this moment, not a great deal of information has yet been shared with the public. In the wake of what occurred here in Kenosha, we have seen demonstrations and we have seen rioting and looting. And I think one of the points that many people struggle with, myself included, is trying to understand the relationship between those two, between the demonstrations and the riots, and the possibility that we are sometimes talking about different groups of people engaging in that activity for perhaps different reasons, perhaps related reasons. But can you help us sort that out, the matter of demonstrations versus rioting, and how you would call the general public to sort that out and understand, in a sense, both the difference between them and the connection between them?
Sure. You know, most people who protest are doing so peacefully. However, absolutely, uprisings, riots do occur. And you know, what much of the research has shown is that when uprisings or riots take place, that it's really the language of the unheard. They are essentially expressions of pent-up anger, which is really symptomatic of systemic societal problems. So ultimately, when there is a deep-seated grievance, such as police violence, institutional violence, which is what we've been seeing take place for so long, and when that has not been adequately addressed, and it's coupled with people feeling ignored and silenced time and time again, that's when uprisings occur. So for people who are constantly marginalized and constantly ignored, you know, uprisings, riots, whatever word you want to use, can ultimately serve as a powerful mechanism to have their grievance heard. But in addition, it's not only a mechanism to be heard. It is a way to oppose and resist the system that oppresses. And so when individuals choose to engage in such a behavior, they're really essentially like bucking up against the system. And so ultimately, it's the language of the unheard. And riots or uprisings draw attention to, you know, these issues that many are trying to spotlight in ways that peaceful protests may not always do so.
So what is your word for someone who lives in this community and perhaps is deeply sympathetic to some of these issues that, of course, do need addressing, but whose own flower shop has been destroyed or whose used car lot has been consumed by fire and completely destroyed and so on? When we are talking about expressions of anger and frustration that that cause destruction and often hurt the very community that that is potentially part of the solution, not just the source of the problem, there is understandable anger and fear stirred up by those kind of incidents. What would you have members of the community do with those understandable emotions at this moment?
Yeah, it's definitely hard, especially for those who are business owners and their businesses are destroyed. I will say that what many activists are trying to spotlight is that, you know, that people are actually losing their lives. And this is a result of institutional violence. And what many activists state is that buildings, businesses, all of these can be built, they can be restored. But yet when someone loses their life, they cannot be brought back. And so there's a lot of focus on, you know, interpersonal violence that takes place, but institutional violence, that is violence from taking place from the state, state officials who are supposed to protect and serve, is just as tragic, is just as necessary to spotlight these issues on. And again, the overarching argument being that lives are more important than buildings.
I think some people would argue that if that is the purpose behind torching a building, and in some cases destroying entire neighborhoods, that is perhaps a means that is to some extent counterproductive. That is,
yes.
One is certainly running the risk of entrenching certain attitudes and certain fears that are part of why we are where we are right now, and that these seem like solutions that might give a certain sense of satisfaction in the moment, a certain release of anger, but yeah. Actually are not part of any kind of worthwhile rebuilding of trust and building up of justice. Is that a fair summation of what we're talking about?
Certainly, you know, when these take place, it doesn't help to build trust. Absolutely, that does not help at all. But I will say that in many of these communities, they're already faced with a host of structural problems, from issues of high unemployment, high rates of poverty, segregation, racial isolation, lack of resources, homelessness, right? So all of these are structural problems taking place within these neighborhoods. And they run deep. By the time, you know, when looting and rioting, when that takes place, and certainly I understand the outrage when that takes place, when people question why does that happen, there are also these underlying structural problems that have failed to be addressed for decades. Again, these deeper structural problems dealing with, segregation and unemployment and lack of opportunities and resources within many of these poor, marginalized communities.
It sounds like what you are engaging in is, but correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like you are trying to explain rather than excuse the behavior that we see in riots and those
yeah.
kind of incidents.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to do, is definitely provide some context in terms of trying to explain why, what much of the research shows in terms of why this takes place, why looting, why people will resort to looting, and why people will, why uprisings take place within these communities. And they often take place because, again, many are resisting a system that already oppresses them.
One of the difficult aspects of what has maybe transpired in Kenosha is the fact that the perception from the community is that as these demonstrations have taken place, and for that matter, the riots that have also ensued, that because of exactly what you're talking about, the legacy of Ferguson and Baltimore and other places where demonstrators were treated in harsh fashion and perhaps in ways that that they should not have been treated, that then in certain other communities, when this occurs, law enforcement officers, for instance, feel a very powerful sense of uncertainty and just what to do, and perhaps demonstrating more restraint than in fact is appropriate. I mean, certainly for the person who owns the flower shop or the used car dealership, they would probably say that that in our particular case, that too much restraint was shown for too long a time. And I wonder if that is part of the legacy that we are talking about, and if that complicates the way in which we look at all of this.
So, you know, what much of the research shows is that when it comes to, for example, the use of aggressive tactics, repressive tactics by the police and police militarization, that it's used heavily on, you know, when people are protesting and they are people of color. You know, the civil unrest that erupted in the summer of 2014 in Ferguson, Missouri, and even, you know, after, following George Floyd's death, it drew a lot of attention to the heavy militarization of local police departments. And its heavy use of heavy military tactics that are directed towards those who are protesting, from the use of tear gas, rubber bullets, long-range acoustic riot control devices, you know, military-style armored tactical vehicles. So, for instance, what happened in Ferguson showed the ways in which local police departments can misuse military weaponry to intimidate and to repress communities. It is one's constitutional right to engage in protest. And I will say also that, in general, there are a large number, the vast majority of people are engaging in peaceful protests. So when you have officers using military equipment, essentially they're coming in as an occupying force and they view the protesters as the enemy. And there's that type of besieged mentality that's created by the militarization of the police and the repressive use of tactics by the police that ultimately sends the message to many communities of color. It's usually used in Black and brown communities, and it sends the message that they are the enemy and that they are not viewed as people worth protecting and serving.
Hmm. I think one thing that is worth our talking about is the use of demonstrators. I mean, the term demonstrators. And looking at our current situation in Kenosha, I think it is tempting, and perhaps it's appropriate, perhaps it's not appropriate, to view those that engage in peaceful or at least orderly demonstrations as one thing, but then those who are engaging in rioting, in the building of burning of buildings and so on, the destruction of entire neighborhoods, that is something else that is going on, and in some cases perhaps we're even talking about different people, some people engaged in the first and others engaged in the latter. I wonder, as you study what has gone on in other places and as you think about what has been going on here in Kenosha, is that a distinction that is meaningful, and is it useful, and is it appropriate? Or do we?
It absolutely is an appropriate distinction. And, you know, we err when we use the two terms interchangeably, demonstrators or protesters and quote-unquote rioters. Oftentimes, they are not one and the same. I know that when I had interviewed protesters in Ferguson and Baltimore, many of them had stated that they never engaged in looting or rioting, and that they did not condone that. However, there were a handful of people who said they did not take part in it, but they understood it, and that it actually took that to draw media attention to these issues. But they certainly are not one and the same, that you have a number of people protesting peacefully. And even, I will say, even after George Floyd's death, protests have been taking place in many cities nonstop. But yet, if you're not in these cities, many people wouldn't know it because they're peaceful. And therefore, it does not bring about media attention. What brings about media attention is when violence takes place, is when looting or rioting takes place. That's what brings about media attention. But that does not mean that peaceful protests have not been taking place and that the vast majority of people engaging in demonstrations are doing so peacefully.
Exactly. I think one of the reasons why I want us to explore this, and why I'm glad to hear your perspective on it, is because of the thing that I was saying before, that one can feel tremendous sympathy for the cause, have feelings have grave misgivings about the status quo and about systemic injustice and so on. And I think those that feel that sympathy, in a sense, do not want that sympathy to be, in a sense, tarnished or undercut by other acts that tend to have that very effect. But I think what you're saying is that there are those who fervently believe that there is no other way to really put this in the headlines, and that if this rioting was not occurring, then Kenosha, Wisconsin would not be the top headline across the country right now.
That is correct. And again, it's the same thing. I mean, it's the same thing that's happened in times past, where it takes it's often the looting and rioting that actually spotlights the issue, because the media just can't ignore it. And even if the media does try, for instance, to ignore peaceful protests, and the use of social media, especially spotlighting some of the looting and uprisings that are taking place, it's going to go viral. And so as a result, we know what makes the news. If it bleeds, it leads. If there's violence, it's going to lead. And so that's what we see taking place. But I will say again that the number of people who choose to hit the streets and protest, they're doing so because they see a grave injustice taking place, and that these are not isolated incidents, that these incidents continue to take place time and time again, and there is real fear amongst Black individuals that they can ultimately end up becoming the recipient, the victim of institutional violence, that they or their family members, their loved ones, can ultimately become the victim of police violence, and for doing nothing wrong, for just simply being, for simply doing some of the everyday things that any one of us should be able to do by living in this country. And so there is fear that simply one's presence, because they are Black, will evoke suspicion and fear from the police and could ultimately turn deadly.
And they could become the next Michael Brown or Freddie Gray or Jacob Blake.
Yes.
Let me
yes.
reintroduce
that
you.
That is actually why. That's actually why so many people actually chose to protest. Like in my study, two-thirds of people who were protesting were doing so for the first time because they felt an obligation to do so, and they felt that failure to do so would mean more Black people dying at the hands of the police. They wanted to see real concrete changes to policy and practices to put an end to police violence and systemic racism. And so the reality is, choosing not to protest, it was no longer an option. People felt that they had a moral obligation to hit the streets and say enough is enough.
We're speaking with Jennifer Kobina, professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University, and the author of a book called Hands Up, Don't Shoot, Why the Protests in Ferguson and Baltimore Matter, and How They Have Changed America. So from your many conversations with demonstrators, first of all, I assume that you have spoken both to, let's call them peaceful demonstrators, I mean, who have engaged in what we really think of as demonstrations, versus those that have engaged in rioting and looting. I assume that you have talked to examples of both, and that, I mean, sometimes we're talking about people who have engaged in both kinds of activities. But when we are talking about demonstrators who end up, in a sense, crossing the line and engaging in this other activity beyond demonstrations, typically are there catalysts that caused them to do so? Because, of course, not all demonstrators do that. Some demonstrators remain squarely, you know, within the scope of demonstration without resorting to violence and destruction. What typically is what drives certain demonstrators to this next level of activity?
I should say that the vast majority of people I spoke to actually engaged in peaceful demonstrations. I think I can recall maybe one or two who actually stated that they did take part in looting. And so the majority of people did do so. They were engaged in peaceful protests. So it's quite challenging to answer that question. No doubt there are some people who go in with the intent of destroying property. But yet at the same time, I spoke to many people who, many activists who actually talked about how they tried to hold the line when people, when there were a number of demonstrators getting really angry and upset, and they tried to make ensure that that they were holding the line so that they wouldn't be aggressively harassed by police, or even for those, I can recall talking to a couple of people who saw people choosing to loot and riot and telling them that they shouldn't be doing that, this is not the way or not the answer. And so, so again, I just want to highlight that, again, those terms, not only should they not be used interchangeably, but there are a lot of demonstrators who are actively trying to stop such actions from taking place.
Right. And I think that's an important thing to say and to say again, that kind of when it becomes rioting, it is not just the shop owner that regrets that. I mean, that bears the brunt of that destruction, but also those who have been demonstrating peacefully, who deeply regret when things, in a sense, spin out of control into kind of a different direction. Just to get very personal for a moment, I feel like I am probably fairly typical of a white male here in Kenosha who suddenly finds my sympathies torn in several different directions, whereas in the immediate wake of the shooting of Jacob Blake, I, like every person I know, was absolutely horrified by that sight, and now I find my horror directed in other directions besides Jacob Blake, and I wonder if these rioters understood that there is the real potential for them to be, in a sense, diluting the horror that all of us should feel over Jacob Blake right now, because now we are also feeling horror at what has happened in the wake of it. But as you say, if we don't speak with many who engage in this activity, it's hard to know if any of them are even mindful of that. Does that make sense, what I'm spelling out there?
Yes, it does. It does. And I think, you know, there are a number of individuals who are not necessarily thinking in the long term about how the effects that it can undercut the overarching message, right, that people are trying to spotlight as it relates to systemic violence and systemic racism that exists in this country. But it really is, you know, for many, again, when uprisings are taking place, it's a way for them to be heard. There is great outrage among some, and anger, and for some, the only way they know how to take that out is by destroying property.
Do we know very much about who tends to be the in the one group versus the other group? I mean, has that been studied to any significant extent? I mean, do we see, for instance, kind of a different level of income or professional standing or so on amongst those who choose peaceful demonstration versus those who engage in this other kind of activity? Or is that very hard to determine, and is it dangerous to make generalizations like that?
Yeah, I think it is dangerous to make broad generalizations like that. The reality is, when people are protesting, we are now seeing like a large array of diverse people engaging in protests, right? From Black, white, young, old, you know, people who reside in urban cities to even individuals in rural and smaller towns. And so it's quite challenging to actually specify, for instance, who's more likely to engage in looting or riots.
Of course, one of the really important stories that you studied in your book, Hands Up, Don't Shoot, in terms of what occurred in Ferguson and Baltimore, is that we are talking about incidents that inspired not just days or even weeks, but months of demonstrations and protests over this issue of systemic injustice. Tell us more about the kind of scope of what we are talking about and why these particular incidents, you think, ended up generating that kind of response.
So, again, as I mentioned, that, you know, both Michael Brown and Freddie Gray, and again, what we see now is countless other Black individuals dying at the hands of the police, they were viewed as victims of injustice. These were not isolated incidents. And so many took to the streets because, again, they either directly experienced institutional violence or from police, or they knew of others who had. And so people felt as if they had to protest in order to try to bring about change. I will say that it's interesting because people are protesting police violence, yet what happened in Ferguson, what happened in Baltimore, and even, you know, what was happening in many cities is we see even aggressive police tactics being used on protesters. We see police violence being used on many people who are peacefully protesting. And so what I have found in my book, Hands Up, Don't Shoot, is that those who protested on the front lines and who are much more vocal about denouncing police brutality and who ultimately they challenged the authority of law enforcement, they were also much more likely to experience and witness repressive or aggressive police action. So for instance, many were more likely to have experienced being tear gassed, shot at with rubber bullets, have physical force used on them, more likely to be arrested or have rifles pointed at them. And yet what was interesting is that for those who were most committed to this movement, they were insistent on continuing to remain active in protest in order to bring about change. For those who were most committed, there were some who felt like they're willing to die for this cause. This is their purpose and calling in life, which is to spotlight these issues of institutional violence in order to bring it to put an end to it. Mm-hmm. I will say, however, there were some who were deterred from engaging in subsequent street protests because of the aggressive and coercive ways that authorities police protest. And for those who were deterred from engaging in future street protests, they did find different ways to try to stay motivated and ultimately engage in the overall ideological goal of the Black Lives Matter movement. So, for instance, some organized and they strategized behind the scenes. Others became grassroots organizers. Some became much more civically engaged, and others became social justice advocates. And so ultimately, the more repressive or aggressive the police were, the more some protesters developed resistance and became much more civically engaged in an effort to root out systemic racism and put an end to police violence that continues to rob so many Black people of their lives.
One conversation that I think is always very difficult to have when we are talking about this is the matter of the incredible difficulty that law enforcement officers deal with each and every day on the job, which is not to in any way excuse the inexcusable when deadly force is used in circumstances where it simply is not called for, when it simply is not appropriate. And yet, there is this other reality that needs to be part of the conversation about the difficulty and stresses of police work and often of the very, very challenging circumstances under which police officers are called to make life and death decisions. What kind of engagement do you think is necessary with the law enforcement community in terms of addressing this issue of inappropriate police violence versus harboring a mutual understanding of what policing is or should be all about?
You know, I will certainly admit the police do not have an easy job, right? At this point, you know, in time, there is so much distrust between communities of color and the police. And so right now, there's a great deal of conversation being had about even the role of police. You know, and the reality is that we depend on the police to solve pretty much every societal problem. We look to the police to solve issues of abuse and abandonment, homelessness, domestic disputes, school disruptions, unemployment, and a host of other societal ills. And, you know, many officers will admit that they are, that we unfairly look to them to solve all of societal ills. And that they will admit, too, that they're not well-suited to having to deal with some issues, for instance, pertaining to drug overdose and mental health. And so that's why we see a lot of calls to defund the police. And, of course, that word can be defined several ways. When they say defund the police, they mean abolish the police department. Others, when they say defund the police, they're talking about reducing the amount of money that is placed towards law enforcement, and instead reallocating those dollars to more human-centered services that work to keep communities safe and help communities to thrive. So, for instance, about $100 billion is spent each year on policing. $80 billion is spent on incarceration each year, where Black individuals are disproportionately targeted. And so calls to defund the police is really about reallocating dollars to investing in, for instance, education, healthcare, housing, and employment opportunities. And so, for instance, the way that would look is that strategically it would be divesting divesting from having police officers in schools, and instead investing in having more teachers and counselors. It would mean divesting from criminalizing mental health, and instead investing in mental health and restorative services. It would mean divesting from military weapons used against civilians when they're protesting, and instead investing in harm reduction programs. And so ultimately, in terms of moving forward, it becomes important to address the root cause of crime, because crime is really symptomatic of much larger societal problems. And so in areas where we do see high rates of crime, we see high rates of unemployment and underemployment. We see high rates of poverty and homelessness. We see poor quality schools and lack of resources. But yet at the same time, a lot of the research shows us what we need to do to prevent or to reduce crime. And that is, if we want to reduce the number of juveniles who engage in delinquent behavior, we need to support families. If we want to reduce homelessness, then we need to provide affordable housing. If we want to reduce joblessness, we need to, of course, provide jobs. If we want to reduce poverty, we need to help people maintain an income. If we want to reduce drug overdose, we need to provide drug treatment. And so this is really about ameliorating the conditions that give rise to high levels of crime. And it really is inappropriate to expect police to address all of these societal problems.
I want to be sure to give you a chance to talk about the subtitle of your book, Why the Protests in Ferguson and Baltimore Matter and How They Changed America. Because we often hear that here we are in 2020 and nothing has changed. And of course, I really think that is a gross mischaracterization. But that being said, we are not anywhere near where we want to be. And progress is, in some respects at least, incredibly slow. And in some places, perhaps progress is even reversed. But you see change in America in the wake of Ferguson and Baltimore. What is the most important change that you have observed?
Well, certainly, you know, the protests that took place in Ferguson and Baltimore, it certainly brought to forefront, you know, it brought to the forefront the issues of race and racism and policing, and it's also humanized the victims of police violence. it's increased conversations and debates regarding police violence amongst academics, police unions, politicians, and the general public. It's also resulted in civilian bystanders now using their cell phones to record police interactions with civilians. And it has impacted political conversations, and it's one of the reasons, again, the Black Lives Matter movement really began in 2013 after George Zimmerman was acquitted in the death of Trayvon Martin, who at the time was a 17-year-old boy. And since, because of the strategizing and organizing and mobilizing of the Black Lives Matter movement, that's why we now see the biggest civil rights movement that this world has ever faced. And so ultimately, we've actually even seen, many cities now have taken steps to reduce the police budget. We have seen, for instance, Minneapolis, Minnesota, they terminated their contract with the Minneapolis Police Department. We have seen other cities following suit. In Ferguson, we did see many more Black officers within the police department. The Ferguson City Council, the majority is now Black, where before that was not the case. The St. Louis prosecutor, Robert McCulloch, he ultimately was ousted after serving seven terms as county prosecutor, and he was replaced by Wesley Bell, an African-American lawyer. There has been the rebuilding of the Ferguson Empowerment Center within the city of Ferguson. We know also that the department in both Ferguson and Baltimore, they entered into a federal consent decree with the Department of Justice. And so those are just some of the things that have been done. Certainly so much more needs to be done, but those are some of just the concrete changes that have been done thus far. But I would argue, again, a lot more needs to be done if we really want to see a systemic change take place.
We have 1 minute left. We are recording this on Wednesday, August 26th. On this coming Friday, you are headed to Washington, D.C. Explain what draws you to Washington, D.C.
Yes, I will. So on Friday, there will be a march on Washington, which is it commemorates the 57th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech, and thousands of people are supposed to be there, and I'm going for personal reasons because I feel drawn to be there, but at the same time, I also will be interviewing protesters and activists who take part in the march to understand what is driving them to the march, what they hope to see, what are their experience, and what are their thoughts in terms of moving forward. And so these interviews will take place virtually. And so it is my attempt to try to also continue to amplify the voice of those who are in the community and trying to bring about change.
Jennifer Gabina is professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University and author of Hands Up, Don't Shoot, Why the Protests in Ferguson and Baltimore Matter and How They Have Changed America, published by New York University Press. Jennifer Gabina, I appreciate you making time for this conversation on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, those of you who were looking forward to hearing Professor Michael Hansen from UW Parkside, that interview has been postponed to a later date. Next week on The Morning Show Monday, I'll be running an interview with Margaret L. Anderson, a conversation that we recorded just over a year ago about her book, Getting Smart About Race, An American Conversation. Next week's schedule of morning shows will also include newly recorded conversations with Dr. John Swallow, the president of Carthage College, and with Dr. Debbie Ford, the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at our website, WGTD.org, and also available as a podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg on Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or Spotify. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts,